Welcome back to the Business of Government Hour. I'm Michael Keegan, your host, and our guest today is Dr. Nicole Lorie, Assistant Secretary for Preparedness and Response within the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. So, Dr. Lorie, healthcare is a cornerstone of emergency response and national health security. What have you observed in terms of the preparedness and integration of healthcare delivery systems, and how has that guided your efforts to improve them?
Well, I think, again, in the beginning of the sort of rebirth of interest in preparedness post 9/11, there was a pretty substantial emphasis on getting hospitals ready and getting hospitals ready to accept mass casualties and deal with a huge surge of patients. Think post-Katrina, there was a re-emphasis on being sure that they got their generators out of the basement and could sustain electricity so that they would be resilient to the disaster and not have to evacuate. But most of the emphasis was on the hospital. I think that we've come to recognize that it's really the whole healthcare system that we're worried about, not just the hospital and not just one hospital at a time. Focus on the community. And then thinking about what is it that we need the healthcare system to do day to day, every day, that we need them to do in disasters. We're doing that through series of drills and exercises that ask people to surge and create immediate bed availability as such of up to 20%. And in doing that, they have to learn how they might clear out their emergency room quickly, how they might be able to quickly but safely discharge people who might not need to be in a hospital but could do well at home with some care or in a nursing home with some care, whatever. How they might need to use an ambulatory surgery center in an event, whatever. So we're building those healthcare coalitions. We're also placing a lot of emphasis on not just thinking you can do it, but showing me you can do it.
So you've made mention a couple of times of whether here or abroad, within the last decade, we've experienced or witnessed many national disasters, natural disasters, emergencies, earthquakes, tornadoes, the H1N1 in 2009, major oil spills, which has a public health effect to it. To that end, would you tell us about your efforts to take what you've learned from all those experiences that you folks were involved in and use those lessons to strengthen our current system?
Well, you know, that is actually a really big focus of what we do. After every disaster, there's what's called an after-action report. And so after everything we do, we sit back and we say, how can we strengthen our system and what's done? And there are a variety of ways in which we do that. And I can give you some examples. I think I talked before about, for example, H1N1. And we recognize that it took us too long to make and bottle and distribute vaccine. And so we've really invested in new technologies and ways to shorten the whole amount of time it takes to get vaccine and to get it out the door. That's a really concrete, tangible example. Moving to healthcare coalitions, again, became really important. And again, after H1N1, you know, I visited some hospitals where when I asked them how bad it was, they would tell me, well, we were down to our last ventilator. And we didn't know what we were going to do if somebody else came in. And I remember asking, so what was going on across town? And they were so busy, focused on their sick patients, that they didn't even think to look up and find out. And so that's the idea of healthcare coalitions really got ahead of steam after that, for example. In deep water, yes, it was primarily an environmental spill, but many, many people had health worries and concerns for their livelihood. And in some sense, on the health side, a large part of it was a mental health or a behavioral health event. People were very fearful. And from that and from some other things, we developed a behavioral health plan for how to deal with the behavioral health aspects of any disaster because they're part of any disaster. And we just never had one before. Recognizing it explicitly let us be able to do something about it. Internally, we've changed the structure for making leadership decisions mm-hmm. as time has gone on. It used to be in disasters we thought that all we needed to do was send out teams from the National Disaster Medical System to help out. Well, it turns out that the whole department needs to come together and make policy decisions almost every day. And so we now have a much more organized and formal structure for doing that. And I will also say that that also runs on top of a day-to-day system for quality improvement, okay, that good business practice, good management practice, being effective stewards of taxpayer dollars requires us day-to-day to think about how to do things better. And so we have a whole series of quality improvement initiatives that run across all of our organization. And they range from things like answering the mail faster to shortening our time for issuing contracts with countermeasure developers and all kinds of other things. So we've taken that really seriously day to day, and we've taken it seriously on game day.
It fosters a culture of continuous improvement, I gather, and sort of excellence.
It very much does. And at the end of the day, my goal is that it makes us more efficient, it makes us better at what we do, and it makes people who are unbelievably dedicated to the mission, working 150% all the time, less fried because they're not having to do as much repeat process stuff, for example. They're working smarter. They're working much more efficiently.
Well, I'm glad you went. And it's a great segue because I want to talk a little bit more about your internal management efforts. And what I mean to say is that we've done a wonderful job explaining your mission and how you actually achieve it. One way, and I've noticed it with some of my other guests, is they talk about the use of data analytics and how they make better decisions. I'm wondering if in your efforts, do you leverage the power of data analytics to make better decisions and perhaps help you meet your mission better?
Oh, very much. You know, and I come at this, you know, from a entire career in research. So at my heart, I'm a data geek. And at my heart, I solve problems by asking and answering questions. So to that end, we're looking at data all the time. We look at data that underpins all of our processes, and we leverage, quote, big data, other federal data to do our job better. So a great example of doing that is in our operations center, where we run a program that we call MedMap, and it's a, you know, it's a mapping platform visualization that lets us look at the country or any part of the country in which something happens. And we can pull data from anywhere so we can know, you know, first and foremost, who lives there, mm-hmm. what is their age distribution, what language they speak, what kind of resources they have to take care of themselves. But underlying that, where are the hospitals, where are the clinics, where are the roads, where are the runways, where are the pharmacies, whatever. And so we pull that together and analyze it in different ways during a disaster so that we know what happens. We just started getting data from the Department of Energy on power outages so that we can actually overlay data about current power outages with data about healthcare facilities, for example, and soon, I hope, data from people who are power dependent so that we can pull this all together and do a much better job taking care of people. So that's one way in which we manage our resources. Our quality improvement programs have us look at data every month, if not more often. And then we have a strategic plan, like most other organizations, that we're really serious about implementing. And so we use data and analytics to mark our progress on our strategic plan, understand where we might be hung up, examine why we're hung up, and think about how to get us on track. This has actually been really rewarding. One other way in which I use analytics, and I'm very serious about it, is in our employee surveys. Because at the end of the day, we're only as good as our employees, and I want to be sure that people get up every day happy and excited about coming to work, that we ask people to do a lot, and I really want to be sure that they're engaged and have an opportunity to represent their views in a variety of ways to me. So one way to do that is through the employee survey. And we actually very much track our scores. We do our own internal survey as well as the federal surveys, and we very much track our scores, implement actions to try to improve situations, and then look to see if they improve.
Well, that's an interesting. I mean, what are you doing to make sure you have the right, well-trained, highly effective workforce? And how does leadership and mentoring fit into that?
Great question. So at the end of the day, as I said, we're only as good as our people. And so part of it starts with making this a place that people really want to come to work. Aspirationally, I would like Esper to be the best place to work in government. We have a great mission, and lots of people very much resonate with that mission and want to come work with us. We celebrate our successes, and we work on improving the things that aren't so successful. I need to be sure that we have very active mentoring programs and that there are career paths that people can see for themselves, paths to development, paths to advance, paths to take on more leadership responsibility over time. So we have a whole series of mentoring programs and development programs within Esper. We take advantage to a very significant degree of a lot of the federal programs that are out there, whether it's the Excellence in Government program or whether it's the Federal Executive Institute. We also have a couple of fellowships where people come and rotate through. So we might have, for example, emergency physicians on a fellowship come and rotate through, or Army War College fellows that might come rotate through. Or I've had people from the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation Clinical Scholars Program come rotate through. And all of those bring new ideas into Esper. They build a workforce for us, and our own internal programs help people develop as well. I'm also, as a leader, I think pretty open and accessible and try to be. So I'll have, you know, an open door hour at least once a month. We'll have a breakfast with a randomly selected group of people across the organization at least once a month. And a lot of times people will come in either just to introduce themselves or because they want career advice and they're looking for new opportunities. And it's great when I hear about it at the front end and I can find opportunities for them to develop in advance within the organization as opposed to deciding they have to leave in order to develop. And so we're very serious about, you know, retaining and developing and providing opportunities for our workforce. People can rotate across different offices, do other kinds of things that often give them the opportunity. And then people have been resonating a lot to our innovative programs, our innovation programs, our innovation space, and having a resource for innovation that people can tap into and use. Because if good ideas come from anywhere, good ideas come from and should come from everybody in the organization, and I need to create an environment where those good ideas can be recognized and really move forward. So we do that as well.
What does the future hold for national health security, preparedness, and response? We will ask Dr. Nicole Lorie, Assistant Secretary for Preparedness and Response within the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, when our conversation continues on the Business of Government Hour.